All right. Are you ready? All right. Hey, what's going on? It's Bill Burr, and it's time for the Thursday afternoon, just before Friday, Monday morning podcast. And I'm not checking in on you this week. Usually I check in on you to see how your week's going, but occasionally I'll have a guest on, at which point I'm talking to them, and hopefully this fills up your ride home. I am with the one and only, the legend from the San Francisco area, from Primus, Mr. Les Claypool. How are you, sir?
I am well. I'm fantastic.
You just got over. You literally just landed, and you came right over here, which is you're just a hardest working man.
I'm a jet setter, as they say.
Yeah.
It's like an Irish setter in a jet.
How was your Southwest, I'm going to guess, flight down?
No, I took one of the – I've never done this before. I took a – it's called – I think it's called Jet Suite.
Oh, that's one of those app jet things.
Yeah, I don't know. My guy out there set it up. I've never done such a thing.
Was there – now, here's a big question that everyone's going to want to know. Did you have to go through any sort of security? Do you just walk on the fucker?
I walked on the fucker.
Big box like Bugs Bunny's.
I got there
TNT.
Earlier than I needed to get, which was like 45 minutes. And I sat in a little lounge and I ate some beef jerky, which I have some beef jerky if you would care for some beef jerky.
You know what? I think I'm going to pass. I just had a bunch of shit food that I shouldn't have ate in the goddamn lounge area here. I should have gone beef jerky. If I could have held out, I could have had a nice protein.
You could
snack.
Have had a nice Jim Beam. Convenience store pack of jerky, but I hopped right on the plane. It wasn't anything fancy. It's not like it's a fancy thing. It's just mm-hmm. a convenient. You know, you don't have to.
It just looks like a plane, but you get
it looks
to
like
skip
a fancy
security.
Plane, but inside it looks like a regular plane with sort of cramped seats and all that. But it was cool. I enjoyed the notion of not having to be scrutinized by a guy and take my shoes off and all that whatnot.
Right. So that all part is perfect, but do they do any sort of screening? Like, how do they know you're cool?
I don't think that was ever a concern whether or not I was cool.
I'm just saying, like, if I'm a terrorist,
it's not the Fonzie airline.
No. Not, I mean, as far as like, I don't mean literally cool. I mean, as far as like the reason why we all go through the security. So now you have this thing that's just generally, if you have the cash and you can download a fucking app, you can just get on this damn plane.
I'm assuming it was my Virgin run. So I'm.
Did you?
I'm
was
learning,
there any? Was there any of that?
Go.
Any of that concern as you got on there? Did you do a quick turnaround to see if it's just trucker hats?
I did not, but there was a woman that came walking in, and I'm assuming she had some form of enhanced buttocks. Like,
oh.
Whether it's the pants that have the padding in it, or she had some sort of surgical...
ass implant.
Yes, because it didn't look like
reality. It doesn't move.
It didn't look like reality.
It doesn't move. Like, first of all, the legs move, the ass doesn't, and then on top of that... is the legs don't match the ass.
Yeah, it looked like something when you were a kid you would draw, you know.
Funhouse mirror.
It didn't look like reality. I'm just going to leave it at that.
Right.
So that was the only thing I noticed. There could have been a bomb smuggled in that form of fashion. That was the only thing I saw that seemed irregular.
Did you shame her?
No.
No?
Well, how would I shame her?
Oh, that's what I would do.
What would you do?
I'd be like, you think you're fooling anybody with that fake ass? Could somebody please make sure?
Really, would you really?
No, what I would do is I would be a coward about it. Is I wouldn't say anything. I would snicker
to
myself, and I would talk it up on my podcast and my stand-up.
Okay, well, there you go.
You've heard of the Cowardly Lion. I'm the Cowardly Comedian.
Cowardly Comedian. I like it.
That's exactly what I am.
Good.
So I know you're a busy man, and you don't have time to just be flying around and just sitting down talking to some fucking middle act here who shames people with fake asses. There is a reason you are a man on a mission here.
I'm a man on a mission.
You have
What's
a new,
my mission? I'm just curious.
You're here to promote things. As most people who are very artistically inclined, I started asking you about your new album that you did with Sean Lennon called The Monolith of Phobos. How do I say it?
The Monolith of Phobos. That was an old album. That was our first album.
That's your first one. So this Correct. New Lime and the Limpid.
Well, that was an EP we did. Our, the new album is different. The new album is called South of Reality.
I literally, before we turned it on, I asked you, what is your new album?
Isn't no, you what said, I said, what were your previous albums?
Oh, did I say that? Yeah. Oh, Jesus Christ. So. All right, what's it called?
It's called South of Reality.
South of Reality.
Yes.
Okay. Is this a nod to Slayer? It's South of Heaven, so you're South of Reality, sort of updated version?
I didn't realize
version?
That we were nodding Slayer, but I do enjoy nodding Slayer on occasion. I have to say, this album, I've never had such a difficult time naming nor coming up with the artwork for an album as
really?
We did.
Is that something that in the past has just come easy for you?
Yeah, they usually just, you know, pork soda. Oh, that's got to be an album title. You know, these things just frizzle fry. They just kind of... but this one, you know, perhaps it's because of the, you know, both Sean and I are very opinionated, but we never could come up with a title that really set the tone or the artwork as well. It took a long time, but you haven't got the artwork here, but it's actually one of the best album covers I have
to look it up now.
It's very cool.
You know what reminded me when you just said, you know, pork soda, like some, that's got to be an album title.
Yes.
That reminds me of Dave Attell. Dave Attell will text me with like the most brilliant joke that no one could think of other than him. And it'll be like, do you have a joke like this? And it's like, no, Dave, nobody has a joke like that. It's like, why would you like pork soda? Who comes up with that? Maybe Beck. Beck had some new pollution and stuff like that.
Like Jeff Beck?
No. The other Beck.
Yeah, I know.
The rapper.
Hey, so... Is that what comedians do? They call each other and say, do you have a joke like my,
if you're
my
concerned,
joke?
If you're concerned of like sometimes, I don't know, you've ever written a song just came too simple and you're just like, did I hear this in a fucking elevator or something? It's the same thing with like.
That's pretty much every Primus song.
Every Primus.
It's just elevator music. Oh, look at that. You got it up there on the screen. This is the modern technology.
Okay. South of Reality. All right. Let's go through this. You know, this is not a visual medium here for people. So. What am I looking at? That appears to be some sort of insect. Does not appear to be on this planet, but he definitely seems to be dealing with some sort of global warming issue here. That looks like he's at the polar ice caps and it's melting. He's got sneakers on. I like that. And he's looking into some sort of...
I like your interpretation.
A compact.
Yes. He's putting on... taking the shine off his nose. That would be a flea. It's supposed to be a flea.
Okay.
Because we have a song called Like Fleas, and so the flea made the cut. Basically, what happened was we were bouncing artwork off each other. Sean's an artist. I'm an artist. We work with a bunch of different artists. And Sean did the drawings for the first album, and somehow the notion came about of let's find... an artist to do something like one of those old sci-fi paperbacks from like 60s and 70s.
Oh, okay.
And I stumbled across this piece of art, and we couldn't find the artist, and we looked and looked, and finally found this guy, and he's this Japanese fellow that Sean ended up knowing about. And he used to do Omni magazine covers and whatnot, and he, after...
Oh, my brother used to read
many
that.
Renditions, he came up with this. So there it is.
Now, how does that connect with the music? I guess I have to listen to the album. Like, this looks like some old school stuff where you just do like that kind of drug that makes you happy. You know, none of that crazy stuff that makes you think you can fly.
And sometimes
I haven't done a lot of drugs.
Thinking you can fly kind of makes you happy, don't you think? The notion,
yeah.
The notion of flight.
Do I get that out of the flea? This right here is why I don't go to museums, because it just makes me feel dumb. I just like there's no scoreboard there. I can't tell what's going on. And then it just ends up making me feel dumb.
I think if you listen to the record, you'll get a notion as to what some of this stuff is. Like Fleas is the closing song, which is a song like flea. The line is like fleas on the back of a dog eventually will be shaken off, which is the notion that parasitic man and eventually, you know, Mother Nature is trying to kick us off the off the planet because we're just screwing everything up. And so Sean said, well, we're like fleas on the back of a dog. So it was
the water will rise up.
It was a moment where, you know, I had this lyric and I read it to him and he said, oh, well, we're like fleas on the back of a dog. And then that became another portion. That became the chorus.
Oh, so that's cool.
That's where the Claypool-Lennon lyrical cooperative comes into play.
I was thinking yesterday, I was out in Santa Monica and I just looked at the ocean, how big it was. It's just like, it's coming for us.
Oh, it's coming.
Would you say that you are addicted to touring?
No.
Because every time I see you, if you're not making an album...
My bank account is addicted to touring.
Oh, is that what it is?
I got a kid in college, man. You got to keep...
Christ.
You know. I do.
Now,
these
did your kid
places.
Get in legit?
What was that?
Did your kid get into school legit, or did you pull that showbiz stuff that happened? I don't know if there was a bit of a scandal down here.
You know how many cocks I had to suck to get that kid into college?
Well, he earned
no,
it.
No, he
then.
Got in legit. What? We're not dealing with chimps here. He's.
Well, I wasn't sure if you photoshopped his head onto like a great.
What were you saying? So, people. Oh, you're talking about the latest thing where people are paying.
You didn't hear. So there was a.
Yeah, I mean,
there was some Hollywood celebrities that got in trouble. They were photoshopping their non-athletic kid's head on top of like some sort of roided up guy. And then the football coach would be in on it, being like, hey, here's a great new, you know, think of like a white kid, put it on some Samoan kid's body, torso or something, and next thing you know, he's the starting linebacker, allegedly, potential for the USC Trojans.
See, I should have done that because, you know, he's going to an art college, so there's no sports whatsoever there. But just the notion that we could have applied that
you could have taken one of those Salvador Dali weird mustaches and the beard thing and just photoshopped it onto his face, and they'd be like, wow, look how creative this kid is.
Yeah, he's trying to get in on a sports scholarship to a school that has no sports. No, he's an artist. He's going to Laguna College of Art and Design. He's learning to make video games. He's been into it since he was like 14. He was taking courses in the summertime at Cal and Stanford and whatnot. He's all about it. That's his whole world.
Oh, so you're out here hustling. Look at you, being a great dad, making sure his dream comes true.
I'm a good dad.
You are. There you go.
One of my better accomplishments.
I wasn't sure how you were going to take the compliment. A lot of people can't take compliments.
I'll take that compliment. I take pride in what I've done with my kids.
I'm a good goddamn father.
I'm a damn good father.
Are you going to be?
I only put 3 cigarettes out on their foreheads.
Well, you got to make a statement. You got to let them know who's in charge.
Got to set those parameters.
You set the tone. Are we going to be seeing the tour bus? On this, you doing a run right now? You doing some dates? Or are we just promoting the album?
I was just told to come down here and talk to Billington Von Buringham, and here I am. I have friends down here. I just kind of popped down here, just come to say hi.
Okay.
But I know we have a record, and we're getting ready to go on tour. The record's new. We did Colbert last week before. You know, we're out there.
Oh, so you're slumming it today.
We're out there starting to shake hands and kiss babies and all that whatnot.
So the press tour is starting to wind down now that you're on my you're starting to do podcasts.
I think it's all winding up. I think this is the beginning. We're about to start touring. And the thing is this year was supposed to be mellow because last year was a big Primus year. We did the longest tour I've ever done in my life.
I saw you guys. I saw you in Austin. It was incredible.
Austin.
At Austin City Limits. I absolutely love that show. And I 3 times in my life I was supposed to see you. And some BS came up in my business, and I wasn't able to go. 3 fucking times. So finally, our paths crossed on the road, and I was able to see you guys in Austin. I performed some dump the night before, and then I went to the beautiful place you guys were at, and I got to see the show, and it was absolutely incredible. Like the way you, I don't know, all the stuff that you do, the way you put together the music with the visual, it's just a whole experience that makes me wish I tried psychedelics at some point in my life.
So you've never tried psychedelics at any point in your life?
No. I've always been like a late bloomer. So I figure I'll try.
You didn't do the thing with your cousins where you'd hold your breath, hyperventilate, and then they squeeze you until you pass out and smack your head on the ground. None of that.
No,
stuff.
I did see some kids at school. There was this big thing. Like, we didn't understand how the body worked. So we thought this was amazing that basically you'd sit there and someone would grab both your jugulars, either side of your neck, and just squeeze them.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah, and kids were just falling over. And
Where did you grow up?
The suburbs of Boston.
Ah.
It was the 80s. Like, there wasn't a lot of information
out
there.
That didn't come to my neighborhood.
Yeah, so we just...
We went straight to methamphetamine.
Oh, you did?
Well, I didn't, but...
You went to... Oh, yeah.
Well, maybe.
I figure... I tried weed for the first time when I was, like, almost 40. So I figured...
What did you think of it?
I'll try... I remember saying, I get it. When I finally got high, I was like, oh, I get it. I get it.
But it's not something you partake in.
I think the way that I'm wired, booze is I should probably smoke weed because I'm probably too wound up. But I relate to booze, like how it makes you feel. And also I feel like there's a trajectory to it that I understand. Like I had one beer. Here I am. Okay, now I've had 2 in this amount of time. And now we go up to the second floor where that shit... It's just like you do it and like nothing happens until it does. And then it's just like someone dropped a fucking piano on your head, depending on the potency of it.
Yes.
And then you start falling, and it's just like, how deep is this fucking hole? Where with drinking, you can kind of be like, oh, okay, hey.
I've seen people go into the hole on the drinking, too.
You can do that. Listen, I'm not trying to get in the way of anybody's fun here. I'm just saying the way I'm wired, where I with drinking, I can see the staircase down to the basement.
Yes.
Where with, like, psychedelics, I feel like I can maybe see, I would think anyway, like, well, I've never done psychedelics. I just was some fucking weed, though. I've ate weed a couple times.
No, and never eat weed. That's the worst. I mean, I saw the last time I ate weed, I saw the light. I saw the light the whole bit, and I literally said, "Don't go into the light. You have kids." It was when my kids were little. And
how many milligrams was it?
I have no idea. I didn't even want it. We were in a van touring the East Coast with one of my little bands and a couple of the guys. Somebody had given us some
Colonel
brownies.
Claypool's bucket of Bernie Brains.
It was the Frog Brigade and Jayski, who's just a human bong, was eating all these brownies, him and a couple of the other guys. And I was just hungry. We were driving to the hotel late at night, and I was like, all right. He's like, man, these things are hella weak. And I was like, all right, let me have one. I'm just going to eat it because I'm hungry. And by the time we got to the hotel, I could barely move. And it was intense.
Yeah, the first time I ever ate weed was like that. My girlfriend at the time brought over a tray of brownies that a roommate had made. And they were probably about the size of like a bathroom tile, you know, big square things, right? So she eats half of one. I go, well, how much should I eat? She goes, well, you're bigger than me. You should eat a whole one. So I ate a whole one and then was sitting there. And looking back, I was getting high, but I didn't, it was coming on slow. So I didn't feel like I felt anything. She goes, and we were going out. She goes, well, you're bigger. Why don't you have another one?
Yes.
So I ate another one.
The slippery slope.
I still didn't feel anything. And then as we walked out the door, I ate her other half. So I had two and a half, then got in a car and went to Newark Airport because we were going to Costa Rica. And it hit me right at the fucking airport. And it was one of the, at first it was hilarious. And then the paranoia came in. And by the time I got onto the plane, I just wanted to stand up and admit everything and just fucking get it over with. But probably for like a 12-hour period, it seemed, I felt like, you know, when your foot falls asleep really bad, I felt like there was a ball of that sitting on my head. And I remember thinking, oh, people say I got baked, I got fried. And I was thinking, I'm literally frying my brain right now. And I didn't enjoy it. For like 2 days, I was like weed hungover.
Yeah.
And that was the end of that.
No, it's actually making me nauseous just hearing the story because I know that feeling.
Yeah.
That's why I don't eat weed.
I just remember there was
I was a big pot smoker for many, many years, but eating,
I just don't like smoke. I don't like putting smoke into my lungs.
Different ball game. But you're a wise man.
Yeah, I'm kind of. Yeah, but then I smoke cigars every 10 days or so.
One every 10 days.
I tried to. Yeah, every week and a half. I have one. I don't know. Red Auerbach lived for a long time. He used to smoke them every time they won a game. He won a lot of games. And he lived a lot of years. How did you end up meeting up with Sean Lennon? Does he have any sort of musical background, by the way?
Not much. I think his dad was a transmission mechanic. That was my dad. Sorry. His band, Ghost of a Sabretooth Tiger,
mm-hmm.
opened for Primus on a tour we were doing with Dinosaur Jr. And we just hit it off. Actually, he and my son hit it off right away because my son's like one of these guys that just absorbs random bits of knowledge and then, you know, regurgitates them to people to, you know, get these conversations.
See, where did he get that from?
And this is way more. This is way more. He gets into all this nerdy stuff. And Sean's the same way. Sean's like Encyclopedia Brown. It's unbelievable. You can get him going on just about anything. And so they're just sitting there blah, 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 talking about the cosmos or talking about, you know, whatever. And so then this was on one of the tours. And then Sean and I hit it off, and we just kind of started jamming one day. I have this little dobro bass that I carry around and fiddle around with backstage.
What is that?
It just looks like, you know what a dobro guitar looks like with a resonator with it's like an acoustic guitar, okay. But it has a big chrome resonator in the middle of it.
Okay.
And they tend to sound a little more metallic. And I have a bass that's like that. So I was twanging away on it, and he comes over with his acoustic, and we start twanging, and I started realizing, wow, this guy's playing. He's not playing predictable counterparts to what I was doing or playing along with me. He was playing some very interesting stuff, and we just made a habit of it, just kind of getting together and jamming. And I said, hey, why don't you come out to Rancho Relaxo at my place and see what we can come up with.
Rancho Relaxo.
And we did.
How does that work? I've always been fascinated because I'm such a huge music fan and was not given the gift, unfortunately, or fortunately.
What are you talking about? I've seen you play drums.
I know, but I mean, it's like dad rock. You know what I mean? If you give me all the answers to the test,
AC/DC is the mainstay of the Australian economy because they're dad rockers. You know?
Yeah, I'm just saying. One time I ever jammed with somebody and they actually had their own riffs, and then I had to do what you were just saying Sean was doing, and there was no answer to the test. It's like, hey, Bill, you know, because before I was just, oh, John Bonham played this. Let's just fucking work on this till I can play it. Which, of course, I never was able to, but I could fake it. But this one, I actually got together with somebody like, hey, here's my creative ideas. What can you creatively add to this? I just kept playing the same beat. I think my face literally turned red. I was like, wow, I knew I sucked. I didn't realize I sucked this bad. So that fascinates me that you got together with Sean and what he was playing caught your ear, like, oh, what is this guy saying? How did you learn how to, like, free yourself up? Like, at what point did you feel that you... like, hey, I'm in this mood, so now when I pick up my bass, I can play the mood that I'm in. Like, I feel like great musicians, you guys are literally just like talking with the instrument. So, like, the way I can be like, you know, how was your day? Oh man, it fucking sucked, but I'm down here and this is my tone. You guys can do that with your instruments. Like, how do you learn how to fucking do that? Blows my mind.
Well, I mean, I have said for a long time, you know, playing music, it's a conversation, and interacting with, jamming with other musicians, you're having a conversation. Some musicians are really great at reading a speech, you know, or classical musicians that can only read the written page. You know?
Right.
I've had people come into the studio and violinists or whatever say, hey, you know, jam on this. What do you mean? You know, where's the written page?
Oh, yes.
And I would assume it's very similar to what you're doing. You know, you can go out on stage and just tell the jokes that are on the page, or you can tell the jokes on the page and throw in a little zippity-doo in between, or
yes,
or take off on a tangent, or full straight improv. I'm sure you've done all those things.
It is the same, but the thing about what fascinates me is with stand-up, okay? It's like all I'm doing is talking. So you come, you know, from the beginning, mama, dada, you start talking, and everybody, like right now, just talking, you're just listening to me, and then you're reacting to it. So you already know how to do that. So as a comedian, all I have to do is make that leap to, you know, making it funny, and then, of course, you know, blocking out the fact that there's a bunch of people staring at you, which is the weirdest thing ever. And
yeah, but now you're saying things that to me are frightening, you know, and I've always been fascinated with stand-up comics because the notion of going out and doing a bit over and over, you and I talked about this a little bit once. You said, right, well, I move it around, I improv, I do this and that, and I get that, but I can go out and stand in front of tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people, if I got a bass in front of me, you know, I got my bass, I can do it, you know, but going out there without that thing, I don't think I could do it, you know, but maybe.
Well, maybe that's what it is. Maybe it just, I don't know. I just think that that's the most fascinating thing ever that like, because I had a period in my stand-up where I would just memorize my jokes and went up and did my jokes. And then occasionally I would try a new one, and it was this big fucking moment. Like, okay, here comes
that. How was that for you?
Here's that new joke. It's terrifying.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
But how was it received?
Oh, most of the time in the beginning of it, it didn't do well. And then I would get panicked, which would make my brain go blank. And then I couldn't remember my act, and then dry mouth. And then it just would all go to shit. But like, I would just by continuing to bomb. Like, if for musicians who are listening to this.
But how did you keep going after that continuing to bomb? That's the big hurdle right there.
I don't know who said it first, but this is the best way to put it. Like, the comics, for the most part, that do make it or whatever or become pros, quitting, it never dawns on you to quit. Because that's what makes sense. It would make sense that if you felt that horrible feeling, you would be like, I don't ever want to do this again, which is what you feel as a comedian. But if you're a comedian, as a person, you feel, but as a comedian, you you don't think, you think, I don't, I'm still going to go and do this. I just don't want that to happen again. And then that's the thing that makes you nervous and makes you live on stage of like, fuck, is that thing going to happen tonight?
But is there that element of, okay, I duffed it. Wait a minute, I just got a great 7-iron shot. You know what I mean? Is there that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely there is. That's what it is. It's that getting a laugh. Yeah, I mean, you literally, in the beginning, you're just living laugh to laugh. I remember that one guy in the crowd.
That one guy.
I heard him laugh. Or that comic who's actually a pro said, hey, good job. Or good stuff.
How soon into this did you get that?
The first time I really got a good one was there was a comic, Mike McDonald. And it's not the guy, rest his soul, just passed away in Canada. It was out of the Boston scene. And I was in this comedy competition, the big radio station, WBCM, which I'm sure promoted Sailing the Seas way back when. They used to have this thing called the WBCN Comedy Riot, and it was at Stitches Comedy Club, and it was to try and find, you know, the best up-and-coming Boston comic. I mean, the scene was just incredible. I mean, I came at the tail end. I missed it, but it started in the 80s that BCN would do that, and it was just like, it was fucking insane if you won that thing. And then, of course, it was the curse of the riot if you made it or whatever. So anyways, in 1993... the last year of it, and Stitches closed like the week after it. And I entered the contest, and my night, it's like if you won your night, then you went to the final. So there was like a qualifying, and then you had your night. So the night this guy, Mike McDonald, was hosting it, I went up and did my bullshit, and I went over and it went well, and I sat down at the bar. I was still working at the dental office with my dad, and he came off stage, and he walked over to me, and he just goes, He just looked at me dead serious, like typical pro comic. Didn't laugh at all or anything, just looked at me. He goes, look, I don't know what you're doing, but keep doing it. And that's all he said. That's all I remember him saying. And I remember being like, wow, I saw that guy on fucking MTV, and he's hosting the riot. It was the biggest thing ever. And then that was a thing over the next year and a half of sometimes doing okay, sometimes having a moment of killing, and then most of the times bombing. That was just something that I hung on to. That guy, Mike McDonald, said, I don't know what you're doing, but keep doing it.
So if you hadn't got that little nugget.
Yeah, that's the thing that scares you. Because I was thinking the other day, I remember that, you know, being an entertainer, we work on those nights when everybody stays home. So it's kind of cool during the week when they have to fucking go to work and shit. But then all of a sudden, you know, the holidays come around and all that, and everybody's gathering around eating, fucking drinking eggnog and having the Norman Rockwell scene, and you got to grab your gear, or I got to fucking put on my stupid sport coat to go do a show. I remember the first time having that feeling was football season, and you know, still living back in Massachusetts, and this is back when you actually had a fall before it just went from January to July. It kind of seems like the weather now. And it was just that perfect, crisp, cold football weather. I was still living at home, you know, just got out of college, and my parents were making a great meal. They had some friends over, and we were watching BC was playing Notre Dame. And it was this big thing, two Catholic schools, and both teams were ranked, and it was going to be great. And I had a fucking show, and I had to go down to Rhode Island to go down to some fucking bar that wasn't a comedy club. I knew it was going to be a hell gig. And I remember saying to my older brother, being like, yeah, man, I don't know, man. I don't think I want to go to this and blah, 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 blah. What do you think? You think it would be bad if I just didn't? And I was booked on the show. I was going to like cancel it. And thank God he just sat there and he listened. He's like, I don't know, man. I think you should go. You should go. And I went, and I remember it sucked going out, getting into my piece of shit. I was old fucking Ford truck, and I got into it. And then once I got on the highway, it just started making sense. Like, yeah. What the fuck was I thinking? What else do I have? I suck at everything. I was terrible in school. This is the only thing I want. Why did, you know, it was just my first experience. I was sort of just like, I don't know. I'd never lived on my own or anything. It was sort of me having to kick my brother, helping me kick me out of the nest a little bit. And I went down there. And so those are two things I think about a lot.
Was it a good show?
No.
Yeah. Older brother, younger brother?
Older. But no, it wasn't a good show. It was I did okay. I think I did okay, But no, none of them were good shows in the beginning. It was surviving. It was all it was. Like my first like year and a half, like very rare would there be like open mics in an actual comedy club. It was mostly a lot of, you know, Boston area. It was a lot of Chinese restaurants, sports bars where they turned down the sound of the fucking Bruins game, but they would leave it on. I used to perform at the 99s and restaurant in Billerica, Massachusetts. And, you know, I Spaghetti Freddy's, they had a basement.
See, I've played like some shitty places. Yeah. But I listen to what you're saying and I go, man, those are just some big ass hurdles for me that I'm not sure I would have been able to get through going and playing Spaghetti Eddie's or Chinese restaurants, or whatever. But the notion too, I was going to ask you, cause I heard you say, dentist's office, you worked with your dad at the dentist's office.
Yeah.
So how supportive was he and your family to what you were pursuing?
Totally. Totally supportive. Like my parents are really cool where, you know, they did what they did and they didn't pressure anybody to, they definitely stressed the college education, but there was just like everyone in my family does something completely different. So you just, I don't know. It's just weird. My family's weird. It's really like loving, but everybody's a total loner. So it's like love is like implied, but it's definitely there. If you were to look at it, it looked like the Brady Bunch, but there was all kinds of, you know, like most families, they had a lot of things going on there. But the thing that I, you know, as you become a parent, I think what you do is you're like, you look at all the great stuff your parents did. You're like, I'm keeping all that. And then there'll be like two or three things that you'd like to adjust. But one of the things that I am definitely going to keep is that thing that my parents didn't judge me, that I wanted to get out of going to a regular college, go to more of a performance school, that I started doing radio, that I got into stand-up, and they were totally 100% supportive. They never thought and never said anything of like, well, Jesus Christ, what if you don't make it? You're going to be fucking destitute. Which was a period in my 30s that I had to deal with when I didn't have any representation or, you know, sleeping on a fucking futon.
But, so they never gave you the, hey, you know, it's, you've been working hard at this, but you might want to, you know, hey, they're looking,
you know,
they're looking,
a dick?
For, they're looking,
you know,
for a salesman over at the Chevy dealership.
No, you know, who was a dick. The our butcher, he was an asshole when he just found out that my mother was all proud going like, hey, he's over at Emerson College and he's majoring in communication. He might have a career in radio. And he's right in front of my mother. He goes, I don't know. Everybody wants to be the star. Like, that's what he said. And I remember looking at him in his bloody fucking apron.
You were standing there when he said that.
And I was just like, yeah, fuck this guy. Fucking cutting up pork. God bless him. Cutting up the pork chops and shit. But like, the fuck this.
We never even had a butcher.
Yeah. You got to have a butcher.
We didn't have a butcher. You just go to the store and there would be some cellophane and away you went.
All right. Well, here's my thing. But the great thing was all I had to deal with was me. I didn't have to figure out how to get along with three, four other fucking people and get in a van and deal with somebody's foot odor. And like, I found with group traveling.
Well, that's where the weed comes in. That's where, because I was not a pot smoker prior to getting in that van with the foot odor and the hippies.
Right.
It was, I'm serious. Like, I smoked some dope in high school. In fact, well, that's a different story, but
tell it.
We've always gotten along very well, but my dad was very young when I was born. He was 19, and my dad was like the Fonz. He was like a cross between the Fonz and Dennis Weaver, you know. And but he was not. He was married. He used to brag that when he was 19, he had a mortgage payment, a car payment, a payment on a washer and dryer. He was a transmission mechanic, and he had a wife and a baby boy at 19. So, needless to say, he was not the type of guy that in whatever year that was running around smoking dope or any of that stuff. He wanted to beat up those guys. So when they found the tiniest little speck of weed in this film container in my bedroom when I was in high school, I got in a lot of trouble for that. In fact, he called the cops on me. He did it to scare me. He called the local guy that he knew, and it scared the shit out of me. And that weed was actually sold to me by Kirk Hammett, by the way.
no way.
Yeah, we went to high school together. He used to sell me weed. But I was not like a big weed smoker. I just kind of smoked to hang and be cool and all the musicians, you know. But I didn't really enjoy it because it was very similar to you. I was a tall, skinny guy, and it would hit me and just, you know, I couldn't control my
brain.
I didn't like it so much. So it wasn't until I crawled in that van in my early 20s with all these dudes, and we start driving across the country, and the joint comes passing by me, and Pink Floyd Animals is on the stereo,
right,
that I went, okay, I'll have some of that. And it made the road so much sweeter. And yeah. I became a pot smoker after that for many, many years, for decades.
I got to ask a question. Where are these fucking high schools? How is your musicians? Like, you listen to Guns N' Roses, it's like, oh, Slash went to high school with Steven Adler. You listen to the Chili Peppers, and it's just like Flea went to school with, blanket on this lead singer's name, Anthony, right? They're just like a whole fucking band. It's just like there's kids walking around, like being like, oh yeah, the bass player from Primus was in my IPS class, and the guitarist from Metallica, I took gym with him. Like, where the fuck are these high schools?
Well, I mean, I grew up in an area. I was born in Richmond, Pinole, El Sobrante, which is Northeast Bay, mm-hmm, San Francisco area. I mean, it's basically all blue collar. You know, where I went to school, you would say, oh, you're taking the test? I'm taking that. Are you? I'm not. Well, I'm going to take the test. Or are you going to take this? Oh, I took the test. And the test was to see what job you were going to get at Standard Oil. You know, Larry Lalonde from Primus took the test.
Right.
And he did very well, but he said, screw that. And he went off and played death metal in a band called Possessed. But that's where we grew up. And so, I don't know. I mean, Kirk was in my algebra class with Mr. Kelly, and Kirk had, you know, he had this dirty white t-shirt and big thick pop bottle glasses, and he sat behind me just divvying up dime bags and looking at guitar magazines. And so I remember, because I would always be singing these songs, and he said, hey, Claypool, hey, man, you want to come sing for my band? And I was too bashful to sing, because I can barely sing now. But so when it came down to it, I couldn't do it. But and then I met this other guy who needed a bass player, and so I begged and pleaded my dad, hey, let me, because we had no money. So I know a guy who has a bass for $30. Let me buy it and loan me some money. And he said, well, if we're going to do this, let's do this right. Let's go see Al over at Al's Music.
And I love that there wasn't the guitar centers back then.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was, but they were not where we lived.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it was just more like local play. I used to go to Norfolk County Music.
Yeah, so we went to Al's Music, and I bought a Fender, a Memphis P-Bass copy mm-hmm, of a Fender P-Bass. And, you know, Al's going to give us a good deal, and I'm not sure Al gave my dad a great deal, but I had this bass, and I had to pull weeds all summer and work for people and whatnot to pay off this bass. But I was instantly in a band, but...
That was the thing. If you were a bass player, it was easy to get into a band.
Everybody wanted to be Eddie Van Halen. Nobody wanted to play the bass. So
right,
it was like, hey. And plus, it only had four strings. I figured it'd be easier. And I was instantly in a band. And away I went. But Kirk, he also had this band called Exodus, mm-hmm, which went on to be Exodus, one of the premier metal bands of the world, after he left Metallica. I mean, after he left Exodus to join Metallica. But we just had a good little music community where we were. We'd all get together and jam at keggers and whatnot, and that's just what you did.
That's I don't know. But I came from more of a jock town, so none of that stuff existed, and it blew my mind.
We were not jocks. As soon as I used to play a little baseball, some basketball, but as soon as I picked up that bass, I stopped. I didn't want any of that stuff touching my hands. My hands became precious. But then I was a carpenter for, you know, 8 years, beating the hell out of my hands. So
how did you develop that? How did you develop? Because nobody plays like you. So who did you listen to that were you actually – I feel like you – if I had to guess, were you listening to a lot of non-bass players to get your ideas?
I was listening to pretty much everything. But right, when I first started, it was definitely Geddy Lee and Chris Squire and John Paul Jones and people like that. And then I got turned on to the Larry Grahams and the Stanley Clarks and the Lewis, mm-hmm, Johnsons. You know, remember Don Kirshner's rock concert? Do you remember that show?
The name I know, but that was a little before my time.
There was no MTV, so late at night there would be the Midnight Special, I think it was called, and Don Kirshner's rock concert, and that's where you'd see.
I've watched those on YouTube. Like, I discovered those like when YouTube came out. I was able to go back and watch the
Yeah, I remember seeing
Midnight
Cheap
Special.
Trick on Don Kirshner's and seeing the Brothers Johnson, and there's Lewis Johnson going, pop, 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 and I was like, oh my God, what the hell is that?
So here's a question. How the fuck did you figure out how to do that? Because these kids nowadays, you can just look up basically any song and somebody will break down how to play it. And sometimes it's actually the guy who literally played it. Like nowadays, it'd be like fucking John Bonham. Hey, this is how I play that quick little triplet thing. You want to do this and blah, blah, blah. Good luck, mate, or whatever.
But no, like, these bastards have it so much easier now. No, we just.
I know, and they're monsters.
Yeah, just sit and just figure it out or go see concerts, which I didn't have any money, so it was hard for me to even go see concerts. But just playing, yeah, just kind of. That's why my style is the way it is, because it's there's no conventional element to it besides I joined jazz band right around then, and my music teacher was shocked to find out that I didn't know how to read music, so he gave me this crash course on reading music, and I just was in the jazz band. So that was the only real theory I ever...
Do you still know how to read music?
But just barely.
Just barely?
Yeah.
You don't really... I mean, your ears are as good as they are. You don't really need to, do you?
I mean...
Unless you're like a session guy, right?
And not too many people are reading music these days unless you're in an orchestra or something.
Is that
like
a hipster thing to do in the music world?
What, read music?
I don't know.
I mean,
you know, they always do all the throwback shit, you know what I mean?
I have no clue. I mean, I would love to – I wish my reading chops were better, but I there's other things I'd rather do at this point than polish my reading chops.
Well, that's right, because you have your new album,
fish to catch.
South of Reality – and that's a flea on the cover. I actually learned what a flea looked like. I never, you know, there was like some little thing jumping off of my dog. With the great Sean Lennon, and you guys are going to be touring. Is it going to be a U.S. tour? You're starting here in the U.S., going up to Canada? What are you doing?
Yeah, I think we're doing three or four tours this summer. So we're starting in a couple of weeks going around the States, and then we go out with Jim James, and then we go out with the Flaming Lips.
So. Ah, that's awesome. By the way, before we wrap this up here, I love your bus, by the way.
La Fonda.
Oh, my God. You bought, like, one of those old-school, like, Greyhound-looking buses that has, like, the roof, and then it goes up, and there's, like, the windows. Is that what it was, or is it straight across?
Straight across.
It is straight across.
It's a
Prevost. It's a Prevost.
Prevost. As they say in France.
And what year is it?
It's an 87.
Yeah, I knew it was an old-school one.
Yeah, it's older than I was. My wife said... a handful of years ago, hey, when I'm letting you know once the kids move out, I'm coming on the road with you. And I said, all right, well, if you come on the road, you're going to be selling some booze because we have a boutique wine label.
What's the name of it?
Purple Pachyderm, Claypool Cellars. But we make, it's very nice Pinot. Like, so I would have brought you some. For some reason, I didn't think you drank.
Because you always catch me when I'm on the wagon. I'm taking this year off. You know, the problem, what I did with booze was I brought it into my house. I let the devil in the house. Because my thing is, if it's there, it's just like a gallon of ice cream. If there's a gallon of ice cream, I'm going to fucking eat it. And there's a bottle of booze, I'm going to finish it. And then the same way, if I eat fast food, then I crave fast food. If I'm drinking booze, I just sort of crave it. But so I just kind of got out of my house and going to take the year. I want to be that guy that has a glass of wine with the meal. I was like, oh, that was great. That was a nice accoutrement to my meal. And then,
well, if you come to my house, I have a lot of ice cream. I have cases of amazing wine.
No, but that's another thing, though. Or it's an event. It's the same thing with cigars. I got them out of the house because I started smoking.
Are you smoking Cubans? Are you going the full? Because I went through a big cigar phase. Many, many years.
Yes,
I still have a humidor full of them. They're like 22 years old or something.
My thing about them is I find that with Cubans is so many of them, they're wrapped so fucking tight that, you know, like when you had when you were a kid and you had like a shake or malt or something like that, and you had to like almost suck your brain out of the back of your head just to get it to come. I feel like
ballpark malts.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, a lot of them don't have a good draw. It's a pain in the ass, and there's some ones that I like more, Dominican or Nicaraguan cigars that I'm enjoying, and they're not wrapped, you know, balled up like a fist. But there's nothing better than a Cuban with a good draw. But like trying to find one, someone gave me a Cuban the other night, and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I was just like, Jesus Christ, my fucking eyeballs are gonna pop out of my head trying to get a little mouthful of smoke here. So I like the Aurora Emeralds. And then there's the other one. What the fuck is it called? I can't remember. I just know what.
So you're smoking like the big old Churchills, or are you sticking with the little, you know, Fistful of Dollars, you know, Clint Eastwood style?
No, not the little ones. Ron White smokes those. I've seen him smoke a few of those, and he looks cool as hell doing that. But no,
I used to steal the old Tijuana Smalls and Swisher Sweets when I was a kid and smoke them in the tree fort. That was always.
Oh, my dad used to smoke the Dutch Master. And then he would always keep the box, and then in there all the loose screws and everything would go in there, inside the whatever, the little kitchen drawer there. So I told you, and, you know, I haven't been able to pull it off yet, but my road bus that I want to get is I want to get one of those. You remember that GMC?
Yeah, you and I were sending pictures back and forth.
You're a busy guy.
You didn't buy that one with the blue leather interior? That thing was cool.
I know. I want to get, I have to work it out, because what it is, if I didn't have a fucking kid, then I would be doing the road like an animal. I could bring my wife along and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I got this whole, I'm rooted now, which is great, and I love it. But
are you rooted here?
Yes, and I love it out here. The dream is I want to get one of those. Have my buddy who built my truck and my dad's car redo the thing. And I'm going to burp here. Eat so much bad food today.
Jerky? That'd help you out.
Jerky. I needed that. If this podcast was at 2, my body would be thanking you right now. I want to get that thing totally like redone, like underneath, like have it still look like 1974, 1975, but underneath be like 2019. And the thing that I would add to it was I would have a humidor. And then it would just be like my vice mobile. So I wouldn't do anything when I was home, which is most of the days now. And I do two runs a month. So I'd be like, you know, and just like one night on each run, I would go hard, you know.
Well,
my face off. And then that would be like times 12 months. That's 24 days a year. I got drunk. Who gives a shit? My liver. But, you know, my doctor. My family. But other than that, who gives a shit, right?
Well, I mean, there's many things in that big statement. One is you can drink. You don't have to get drunk. I mean, I drink the wine because I enjoy it, every night. And
That's called being mature.
And, you know, with some beef jerky, it's all good. And then the rig. I'm that guy. If you're looking for a vehicle, an older vehicle, I'm the guy, because I always tell people I don't do social media. My version of social media is going on Craigslist and looking for old car parts. And I'm not bullshitting. I'm always looking for Chrysler parts. I'm looking for this and that and the next thing. So when I hear somebody's looking for something, and I did do a little digging for you at that time, and then I forgot. Mm-hmm. But I used to have a 23-foot Birchhaven GMC. The 23 is, well, there's
a
20.
Are you kicking the table? Something's happened here. Oh, down there. I just noticed it.
It's the 23 and the 20. There's the 26, and then there's the 23. The 23s are cool because you can take them into most campgrounds that don't normally allow RVs.
Right.
And the Birchhavens were the only – the Birchhavens and the Royales were the ones that actually had real wood interior. So.
Oh, I remember you sent me all of that stuff. Yeah, but it's a whole subset.
Yeah, and there's websites about these things. They're amazing rigs. And when you drive them, it's like driving a Cadillac. And the way the windshield wraps around you, it's almost like you're sitting on the bumper, you know. They're really incredible rigs.
Now, with a few times I've done tours and I rented a bus or anything, the thing that I did love about that was, first of all, the guys that I toured with, three of my great buddies, and like it was like you were so excited to do the show, and you'd pull up in the bus. It was fucking awesome. And then you'd go and you'd do the show, you'd have a great time, and then we would get on the bus, and you'd be so excited, and we'd put in like Goodfellas or Anchorman or something like that, and we would just sit there laughing the whole night, you know, drinking and eating and just watching movies. And it was like the camaraderie on it was incredible. And I do miss that. And, I have to figure out a way. I've been toying with it, because my thing is, I think I want to do it is to just hire a driver, and then he just has it.
That's a different thing than getting the GMC, right? I mean, that GMC.
No, but I want to
like
get the GMC and just have the guy, he just has the fucking thing.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Right? And it's just like, all right, here's my tour. It goes from here to here.
Because the buses, so like the Prevost buses, that's a whole different level. That's like, you know, million-dollar rigs. And they're amazing. And
that's why I don't do it anymore. Because when I got the bill, I was like, Jesus Christ. Because he was, driver's going, you want to leave tonight? I was like, yeah, let's get the fucking drive out of the way. I didn't realize I was paying overtime. So I already paid. I was like, I already one you know, gig and a half is out the fucking window. And then the bill came. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, it was like,
well, you got to stop playing them Chinese joints. And then you can step it up.
Well, anyways, the album is called South of Reality. You don't know where they can get it. I'm assuming that you can get it on iTunes and all that. It's like psychedelic music. It's two incredible musicians, Sean Lennon and Mr. Les Claypool. Thank you for doing my podcast, and thank you for we're going on three solid decades of incredible music. And I love everything that you do. Tim Alexander, one of my favorite drummers of all time. Brain, everybody that you play with. I just love the musicians that you work with. So I'm going to be downloading this when I get home. If my wife teaches me how to do it.
There you go.
I will definitely be doing it. So look for the tour. Three tours, right?
So far, yeah.
Oh, by the way, I got to read an ad here. You want to see something inspirational?
Right? I'm ready.
Watch me try to read out loud. All right. Oh, look who it is. It's my bookie. Hey, how you doing? Brackets. First round upsets the final four. March Madness is here. And it's time to bet with the best at my bookie. Would you rather sit at your office desk or call out sick? And I love this degenerate shit. Yeah, blow off work. Call out sick and binge on the NCAA tournament games and junk food like that's even a choice. Sometimes it feels good to be bad. These guys are wonderful, especially when it's with someone you trust. They're already saying fake sick, and now they're going to act like they're trustworthy. And if you're looking for a place to get in on the action, you can trust MyBookie. They've been in the business for years, and they're growing like wildfire. The best part is they pay out fast. So when you call that 12 over 5 upset this year, I don't know what that means. Make sure to celebrate. You'll be pocketing cold, hard cash. Here are the core talking points. March Madness is the most exciting action-packed sporting event of the year. Even grandmothers fill out a bracket. My mother does. She picked Holy Cross a couple of years ago. You play, you win, you get paid. Or you lose, you get evicted and you suck dick. Okay, I'm just being devil advocate here, right? Only at mybookie.ag. And now you can listen to a little 15-minute clip of me on the radio show talking with some of the guys about some of my picks, and then listen to a classic Thursday afternoon just before Friday, Monday morning podcast to follow. Thank you guys so much for listening, and thank you again for all the great stories and all the wonderful music. All right, Les Claypool, everybody. Les Claypool, South of Reality.
One.
Bill Burr on the Sports Gambling Podcast is brought to you by MyBookie.ag. MyBookie is the leader in online sportsbooks. Use the promo code BILLBETS for a 50% deposit bonus. Play, win, and get paid at MyBookie.ag. Joining us on the MyBookie.ag hotline, the one, the only, Bill Burr. Bill, it's March Madness. Are you one of those guys who fills out a bunch of brackets? Are you going to fill out a bracket?
I used to be that guy. I got a kid now. So I try to watch the games between watching like the Mickey Mouse Club and Puppy Dog Pals.
Oh, I feel your pain there. I feel your pain. The kids have been out of town for like 4 days. So I've like just immersed myself in college basketball.
It's awesome. I got her to say, my daughter will say, watch hockey, watch basketball. She knows what it is. But then like about 3 minutes in, she's just like, I want to watch dogs. Meaning Puppy Dog Pals. So I essentially, all I watched was highlights of Zion Williamson's like whole career, him blowing out the speaker and all of that. All, you know, that ridiculous block shot where it looked like somebody photoshopped him in continuing to go up after he blocked it.
Oh, so that's a great highlight.
I paid attention to it.
Yeah, that's
incredible.
Yeah, that's like the highlight of the year for college basketball for sure. He blew out his shoe and he also kind of hurt his knee. And then there was this big debate in the, you know, amongst the sports like talking heads, whether or not Zion Williamson should come back or just rest the rest of the year and miss out on the tournament.
It's pretty cool.
I know. I mean,
go ahead, Bill.
It's the only good thing about that sort of dialogue is at some point they're going to have to pay the kids. If they're going to want to stay and not have conversations like that, and I would just basically give them some sort of money. Man, when you're a college kid, if you had like $200 a week, you were you were filthy rich.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think we're close to that. They can't continue this charade of like amateur athletics, but we're going to sign billion-dollar contracts with the TV networks. I mean, specifically, I like how Zion's kind of like, nah, man, I want to play ball with my friends. Like, back up, you know, I'll make some money in the future. But I do think it's funny that everyone had to have an opinion about this, what this kid wanted to do. And he's like, well, I'm a kid and I want to play basketball with these dudes who I'm friends with. So
it's at the very least, they should just let them, you know, make money off their own name. You know, if there was a guy on a math scholarship and some like compass company wanted to pay him a bunch of money, or a graphing calculator company wanted to pay a bunch of money to him to use that graphing calculator, the school wouldn't have a problem.
Sean, he's an amateur athlete, please.
It's just because the colleges wouldn't be getting a cut of that, and they already have these shoe deals. That's the real issue.
Yeah, it's going to be, what happened was, since the beginning of college athletics came television. And then the internet, streaming, and all of that, and it became this billion, multi-billion-dollar business. And they've been able to hire. Well, they're amateurs. You know, to take the purity out of the game. I will tell you the one thing I do love about the college game is that the players have to listen to the coach. And I think it's everything that's wrong with the NBA game right now. Where, you know, I was watching. I'm not gonna say the guy, but I'm watching this team, and this team is playing better without the star, and then he comes back, and it's just all about him. So they started to kind of discuss it, and one of the color commentators goes, well, you have to understand that when you get a player of his caliber, he's going to have to get his touches. And it's just like, you know, to hell with his touches. You got to get a win here. And it's all about, like, I swear to God, like, watching the pro game now where, you know, it's a game of runs. The other team's on a 10-0 run, and my team's still launching up threes. With nobody underneath, nobody's getting benched. I didn't see one pick and roll the whole game. It's just it really is a completely just different game. And so we like the college game better, but it just sucks when that they don't pay the kids, and then also you only get to see Coach K develop a guy like Zion for just 1 year, as opposed to, like, I really think, like, the last big guy that stayed 4 years was from the Spurs. Just blanked on his name.
Duncan? Duncan was Duncan. He stayed for a while for sure. Yeah, I do think there's that element of like, I want to root for these guys year after. I mean, part of the reason you like rooting for a pro team too, like, that's going away. It is becoming, I feel like the millennial culture, and plenty of people have talked about this specifically in basketball. They root for players now.
Yeah.
Like Odell Beckham would be a good choice too. I know a lot of people are getting Browns jerseys because they're Beckham. It's like, what is this nonsense?
You support,
like,
your team. You support your city.
Defend the shield. Come on.
It's fantasy football. It's fantasy football. And also, you know, like I don't begrudge any of those kids not staying for 4 years. I mean, it is insane. And I think that them leaving will, even then, they're never going to open up enough of the wallet to get those kids to stay compared to what they would make as pros.
Yeah, I mean, even if
I just know in my business, if I sell out an arena, I get a nice check at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's the ultimate bringer show, right? You're bringing the entire crowd.
It's the Fab Five thing. You know, Jalen Rose, Chris Webber are walking down the street. The college is making tons of money. They're selling their jerseys for $100 a pop, right? But they don't have enough money to pay for it. Like, that's, it feels like you could very quickly fix that by saying, if we sell a Zion Williams jersey, you get a piece of this, period.
Yeah. Piece of the merch. My favorite thing is when people are like, they get a free education. It's like, then they're not getting a free education. What they're doing is they're going to school to play a sport. That's what they're majoring in. And they're making the school billions of dollars. You know, especially with, like, football, how sophisticated the offense and the defense and all that. You don't have time to, like, be going to class and all of that type of stuff. I mean, it is what it is. And the reason why those schools have all those beautiful buildings is because of the sports program. So, I mean, they should be getting, I don't know, should be getting a little something, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's all those chemistry advocates there donating hundreds of millions of dollars to build buildings.
It is...
I know. I mean, it's a sad state, though, that if some really smart Asian kid transfers in, that's not as big a deal. And then you're going to have this genius kid coming in. Genius, I should say, academically. You know, not to say that there's not sports genius. you know, that he comes in, that that's not as big a deal. Like, you know, like if he's like the Goodwill Hunting kid, right? And he solves the math problem, that there's not like a big ESPN segment on it.
That would be hilarious if people walked around with jerseys that just said, like, genius Asian kid on the back.
He's figured out the first 31 trillion places in pie. It's like, who gives a shit?
Yeah. Well, the closest thing to that is the Stone Bee, but I think everybody kind of watches it because it's funny to watch those kids during their awkward years, like, freaking out.
Oh, man.
They spelled, you know, grasshopper correctly. That's how dumb I am. That's the biggest word I could think of off the top of my head.
It's somewhere between a blooper reel.
Grasshopper.
It's definitely a novelty thing that people are watching for comedic. Like, they don't play the highlights on SportsCenter because they want to show some awesome words.
Yeah.
They really just want to make fun of these kids. It's kind of fucked up.
They want to have some gif of some kid sweating and his, like, facial reactions and his glasses. And, yeah, yeah, that's what they're looking for. Not the celebration of spelling.
My favorite is when they spell the one to win the whole thing, they spell it so slowly, it's like they're counting down instead of like 2, 9. It's like like freaking out.
Yeah, it's like it's a more intelligent approach to Wheel of Fortune.
Oh, absolutely! That's still one of my favorite shows. I still can't. Even when they're down to the finals, I can't figure out. I would say 80% of the puzzle.
Bill,
let me ask you this. Considering I saw so little, my college basketball team has always been the Kansas Jayhawks. And I went a powerhouse this year. And I think, where are they in the spectrum of it?
They are definitely one of the teams that people are throwing out as, don't be surprised if Kansas takes an early exit from the tournament this year. They've had some issues all year. And I think they're what, Sean, a 4 seed?
Yeah.
They're taking on Northeastern.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah, they're a 4 seed going up against the 13 seed. This was the first year that in the Big 12 tournament they weren't a number one seed. So
it's been 14 years since they didn't win the conference, I think.
Yeah.
Something insane.
It's been a crazy year off for them, but those are sometimes the teams you have to be on the lookout for as far as betting on. Teams with that kind of history that maybe just had a down year in the regular season. Solid coaching, they could kind of turn it on, make a run. I mean, that's what I kind of think Villanova's going to do. They've won 2 of the last 4 national championships. They didn't have a great regular season, but they played well, winning the Big East. I think they could make a little bit of noise.
Yeah, just to tie it up, Kansas is playing Northeastern in the first round, -6.5-point favorite. So people still liking Kansas. I think.
Wait, not Northeastern, Boston.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, they're in it.
We you know, because
we were
going to talk to you. I looked through it. I combed through it. I'm like, which Boston teams are going to be in the Northeastern? Is the only Boston representative. And yeah, they won whatever conference they're in.
Look at that dilemma right out of the gate. My Kansas Jayhawks are going. I got to go Northeastern though, man.
All right, so you're going Northeastern.
So you're not a millennial who's just going to follow players. You got to stick to the homegrown.
I'm a townie. I'm old school.
Nice. I like it.
So maybe ride the Huskies with Bill Burr catching 6.5 points.
Yep.
Bill,
I'm going to watch it. When does the tournament start? Wednesday, Thursday?
It starts tomorrow morning. I think the first game tips at 9:15 Pacific time. Northeastern Kansas is going to be at 1 p.m. tomorrow.
Oh, that's got cigar bar written all over it. I'm going to be sitting there smoking a stick watching that. All right, I love it. I love it. All right, well, go Huskies.
Go Huskies. As a comedian, you know, it's easy to get annoyed, I think, at you know, the announcers when they try and be funny. I think the one exception though is Charles Barkley. Are you a huge fan of watching Barkley as a color commentator or analyst?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a lot of great ones out right now. I'd say the best one that's in the line years is Tony Romo in NFL.
Oh no.
The amount of stuff that you learn when you watch that guy play. That guy, he breaks down. I saw one time he talked about at the end of the game, the Patriots had it won, and Belichick was changing up some stupid thing. He was going, he's literally doing what he's doing right now. This has nothing to do with the game. This has to do with throwing off other coaches, trying to figure out his tendencies. This is how far ahead this guy looks. I love Tony Romo. I heard one of you groan, but I love him.
I just love that he waited to, he saved his greatness for after he was done playing football for the Dallas Cowboys. So
yeah, I mean,
I do.
He was great. Oh, he was great, too. The guy had like 19 quarterback coaches. That wasn't his fault. His problem is that owner who looks like he should be on the Kardashians with all that Botox in his face. That's his problem. That guy stepped in S in the beginning when he got Jimmy Johnson, and he couldn't handle that Jimmy was getting all that credit. He has a high-speed elevator going down the field. Their problem is their owner. It was not Tony Romo, but he's the quarterback, so he took all the brunt.
He does have a Montgomery Burns type vibe, Jerry Jones.
He has a high speed elevator to get down to the field so he can run out there and get some face time when they win. That's not staying in your own way.
Yeah, that is that's a horrible move going on the sidelines. Just ask Arthur Blank of the Atlanta Falcons when they were up 28-3 and he goes down there with his wife and they're holding the hands as the lead slowly slips away and the Pats go all the way back and win in OT. You got to stay in your box.
That was right up there with watching somebody blow, like choke on Sunday playing the Masters.
Yeah.
There's nothing like choking in golf because it takes so long. All other sports, he throws it up and it's an easy ball. He misses, game over. Like you like choke for like an hour.
I mean, do you remember the Greg Norman choke job where it was it was a holes and you're just, I mean, I remember as a kid watching it and just be like, oh my goodness, this guy is completely ruining his life right now.
Time just slows down.
Like he looked like a guy in a public course.
I was going to say that's what happens when you're playing a foursome at DeBell in Burbank and you're playing with a guy who just freaks out and on the third hole he's throwing his clubs and it's like, all right, well, this isn't going to go well.
Who is that guy? I saw like, it was like 10 years ago. The first time I was like, I'm going to watch the Masters from Thursday right through Sunday. I watched the whole thing. Is it Kenny Perry?
Oh, that...
No, what the hell was his name?
I forget
the guy's name. He had the whole thing on. His kids were on the 18th hole crying with joy, and their tears of joy turned into tears of sorrow, and they went into the overtime, and he lost. I forget who he lost to. And he said afterwards, when he reflected on the loss, he said when he filled out his scorecard, he didn't even talk to his family. He just got in his car and started driving. All right. And here's the thing. I've been to the Masters, and what blew my mind was, you think the way the course looks, that it's in like this Beverly Hills town, there's literally like a Hooters. You walk by that, and then you go on the golf course. There's like a Best Buy and all this. It just looks like a regular, you know, strip mall sort of area. So he left, went down that whole road with all those beautiful trees, and then just pulled out and went by a Hooters. Just driving down the street. Well,
it's funny you say that, Bill.
It was one of the worst things I ever saw.
You're right. It was Kenny Perry. It was 2009. So stellar memory. 10 years ago did collapse. Yeah. I've also been to Augusta and it's kind of like when you visit a very prestigious university that's dropped in the middle of a bad part of town. And there's just, you walk through some
Notre
gates.
Dame.
Yeah. You walk through gates, Georgia Tech and Atlanta USC. Is like this. The USC is a little, you walk through some gates and all of a sudden the grass is green and things are nice. And you're like, what the fuck's going on here?
Yeah. It kind of makes you think about society a little bit.
You go on the outside of the gates of the Augusta and it's strip malls and barbecue joints like that. That's all there is down there. Yeah. They call it Disgusta for a reason, Sean.
It's funny you mentioned that Hooters because, every year at that Hooters, John Daly shows up in a RV and just hangs out at the Hooters parking lot and just signs autographs and talks about his crazy days.
What a life that guy has.
No, he's really on top of it.
No, he's one of the, he really is. He's like one of the great Americans out there. He's really misunderstood. I love that guy. There's a great clip on YouTube of just some of his longest drives and like the torque and the speed of the head of his club. It's so ridiculous. I laugh like I'm watching a stand-up reel, like just at how the raw power and just having that all synced up. You ever see that when he was just telling stories about, like, you know, how he played better drunk? I mean, now it's considered sad. It's a disease and all that. All the old NFL players have stories like that, from Bobby Lane to, like, Ken Stabler. There's a classic story of John Madden giving Ken Stabler shit for going out and partying the night before and saying, like, he's too tired or whatever. And he just finally looks at him and he's like, coach, he's like, how much rest you need to go out and play a couple hours of football?
I mean, think about Michael Jordan in the Olympics.
Like he was playing pickup.
Yeah, I mean, Jordan was probably enjoying cocktails on the golf course. Yeah.
Lawrence Taylor.
Oh, well.
No, I mean, that
was the opposite. That he was all into uppers. Uppers only.
Well, John Daly had a great, he was doing an interview and he explained that he had trouble putting because every time he would go to putt, as he was pulling the club head back, he would start thinking about how much he owes his wife in alimony. He was paying her $35,000 a month. He goes, I can't hit a goddamn putt anymore. All I do is think about how much money I owe her.
Yeah, it's so sad. Yeah, someday, I hope this progressive era comes around to that. You know, alimony and child support at some point, you know, there's got to be a little nod in our direction.
Maybe one day Daly will get some of that money back. Bill, before we go, just your thoughts on NFL free agency or the NFL offseason, the big Odell Beckham trade, Antonio Brown. He didn't want to play for the Bills and he ended up getting traded to the Raiders. Le'Veon Bell.
I think that's such BS that players can do that now. It's like, how long does Buffalo have to wait to get a great player? They made, you know, he had and falling up with the Steelers. The Bills made a move and they got him. And then he's just like, oh my God, I like Saturday, I don't want to play there. And then it's just like, he gets to go somewhere else. It's like, well, then go to the CFL. Like, I don't understand how they run in the league. I mean, it goes all the way back to, like, you know, Kobe Bryant, John Elway, all of those guys.
Eli Manning.
Understand, I will say with an NFL quarterback, because if you go to a bad team and they have no offensive line, like, your career's going to be over. Like all that, like the Joey Harringtons, where he's like, oh, that guy was a bust. It's like, he's a bust. He went to the Lions. Who knows what he could have been? He wasn't running for his life for 3 years. So, I don't know. I think and to get to what the Browns are doing, it kind of seems with Baker Mayfield's swagger and, you know, Odell, his emotional issues or whatever, they're kind of becoming the Midwest Oakland Raiders. So maybe that'll work if they can get a bunch of free spirits in there, as they say. I think him and Baker Mayfield are going to be great together.
Yeah.
I think it's exciting just to see Browns fans excited. I'm happy for that.
I do agree with that. I do find it interesting that we as a country feel sorry for Cleveland and always want to prop them up when there's an opportunity. But yeah, it does seem like Odell Beckham walking into the Browns locker room is like the dude smoking the cigarette walking through a gas station.
Yeah.
Like it may turn into nothing, but it also may turn into a very awesome situation
It could come down. And Jarvis Landry, he's no wallflower, that guy.
Bless him.
Supposedly he's best friends with Odell, so maybe they make it work, but he's a guy who loves getting the ball and is going to make that a point. So if Baker can kind of balance,
I don't know,
those
man.
Two,
I'm starting to see an old timey, like 1970s NFL team get put together up there. And I really hope, I hope it goes the positive way and they become like this hilarious, you know, exciting team to watch that has like the best interviews afterwards. Cause they all say a bunch of crazy stuff. That's what I'm hoping for.
Well, and the networks are clamoring to get Cleveland Browns games this year. So
yeah. That's imagine new. That. We're going to see
that's new.
Multiple Cleveland Brown games in prime time. Yeah. It's been a long time.
My uncle's going to roll over in his grave.
But the Browns fans in general, Cleveland is a real legit sports city. Any team like that, that has so many diehards, whether it is the Browns or the Bills, teams that maybe the city doesn't have a lot going on besides the team, you got to root for those fan bases. So it's good to see they're getting some big time players in there. Bill, as always, appreciate you calling in to the podcast. Make sure you check out Bill's Monday Morning Podcast. F is for Family. Anything else you got going on, Bill?
I got season 3 of F is for Family is now streaming on Netflix. It's an adult cartoon, I would say. Yeah. Definitely some vulgar language. It's got a lot of heart. Don't watch it around your kids. We got 3 great seasons, and we're wrapping up season 4 right now as far as writing it. And season 4 should be out next year.
A quick sidebar to that. One of my kids stumbled across F is for Family. And I had that moment where I was like, how the no, stop. But it is funny.
Great show. Great time
yes,
as always.
Is. Yes, call- is. I'll let you, as you guys as parents decide your own, what you're going to do with your kid.
Yeah. Just know
my kid isn't watching it. Put it that way.
I'm not a big fan of censorship, but I maybe applied a little censorship.
Yeah, you gotta figure out the right age. All right, thanks as always.
Yeah, you
Bill.
Gotta let him have a childhood. All right, guys, we'll see you. Go Huskies.
All right, appreciate it. Go Huskies.
Take care, bro.